The sponsor of this week's episode of the Mobile Dev Memo Podcast is Incremental. Is your iOS performance looking stranger and stranger? Do your decisions seem all wrong? Is your Facebook CPI above $50? If you know what I'm talking about, that's because the measurement paradigm has changed, but your tech stack hasn't. Incremental is the first and only always-on incrementality measurement that doesn't rely on user-level data or complex experiments, allowing you to get true value measurement for all of your channels, campaigns, and ad groups, whether you are on iOS, Android, influencers, TV, or even billboards. The platform is already used by some of the largest and most sophisticated advertisers in the mobile space. Join the future of marketing measurement today with Incremental. Google Incremental, the future of measurement, or use the link in this episode's description to learn more.
The problem is that the distinction needs to be drawn between the competence of the economists and the correctness of their analysis.
Welcome to the Mobile Dev Memo Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eric Seufert, and I'm here today with Paul Bannister. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Eric. How are you?
I am doing well. It's Friday. It's a nice day in Austin. And you're returning to the podcast. This is your second time. So I imagine many of the listeners are familiar with who you are and likely follow you on Twitter. But for those who don't, could you please introduce yourself?
Sure. Paul Bannister. I am the Chief Strategy Officer of Raptiv. Raptiv is a ad management firm. What we do is we are the exclusive manager of advertising for about 5,000 sites on the web. We're a web-centric company. Those 5,000 sites kind of run the gamut from every vertical, every type of site. And with that scale of those 5,000 sites, we have a very large scale in general. We're the largest source of ads on the web at this point. And so when, you know, as things are changing on the web, and our topic today obviously is third-party cookies going away and things like that, with the scale that we have, we think a lot about like what can the future of advertising on the web look like? What are the things that are changing? What are the things to get ahead of? And that's kind of a big focus of ours, is kind of getting ready for this future world without cookies and that is more privacy friendly in general.
And you are the perfect person to have on the show to discuss this topic, which is, I guess, really kind of two topics. It's the end of third-party cookies on Chrome and Privacy Sandbox. So that's what we'll be discussing today. And you were one of the first people to kind of publicly report on third-party cookie and Chrome deprecation / Privacy Sandbox results. That was 3 months ago?
Yeah, early January. Yeah.
So I guess a natural first question to ask is, what is the current state of things? Has anything changed since your original assessment? And maybe remind people what that assessment was. If I remember correctly, it was something like 35% reduction in CPMs. So has that changed? And what's the current state of things?
Yep. So the data from so just to level set, Chrome is deprecating third-party cookies this year in theory, although they've delayed multiple times before. So, you know, probably will happen, but you never know. On January 4th of this year, they deprecated third-party cookies for 1% of all Chrome browsers globally, which gives kind of everybody the first view into like what the future world could look like. There's a number of reasons why that's actually not a perfect test, but it's the best we've got, so we go with that. We were able to run an analysis about a week after that deprecation and kind of see what the first view of the world was, which was about a 30% drop in ad revenue. So not just CPMs, but like overall, you know, ad revenue, which includes fill rate and other kind of factors together. So pretty material. That's a, you know, for a lot of publishers on the web, like that would be, if not a death blow, it would be a serious hit to their business. And that's a real problem. It is better than the way Safari looks. Safari hasn't had third-party cookies for years now and has also eliminated a lot of other tracking services. Safari is 50 to 60% lower than Chrome with cookies. And so Chrome without cookies is sort of in this middle ground. And a lot of, you know, our work and the industry's work right now is figuring out how to kind of close that gap back. So that's kind of where we were 3 months ago. 3 months later, not a ton has changed. You know, maybe worth talking about kind of why there hasn't been a lot of change. The one thing, we look at a number of different cuts of the data, and one interesting one is what we call the recovery rate. So we'll talk more about Privacy Sandbox specifically in a minute, but the idea is that within Chrome, you can run a test in a world without third-party cookies. What does revenue look like with no replacements for cookies? And what does the world look like with the Privacy Sandbox turned on? And so when you measure that difference, we are able to measure a bit at about 5 to 6% recovery rate right now, which basically means that the Privacy Sandbox technologies, when enabled, are recovering about 5 or 6% of that missing 30%. So it's like beginning to tick back up. That number was about 3% 3 months ago. So that number is moving in the right direction, but at a pretty slow rate right now. That needs to be a lot faster if we're going to deprecate everything this year.
Got it. So two follow-up questions to that. So first, why is the 1% rollout and the various circumstances of that not the best way to test the effectiveness?
You know, I think a lot of the issues are sort of like macro in nature. When 99% of Chrome browsers still have cookies, there is limited reasons for many advertisers and buying platforms in general, like DSPs, to spend money outside of that. So a lot of the money just stays in the 99% and doesn't migrate to the 1%. So that's one kind of like macro factor. Another factor is that on the reverse side, if we actually got the parity in the 1%, where it was actually monetizing just as well, like that could just mean that when 100% go away, that that money that was in the 1% now gets distributed evenly across the other 100%. And basically it's like 1/100th of the money in each bucket, if that makes sense. So a little bit like there's just these macro factors that like are a little hard to forecast where they'll shake out when the number goes from 1 to 100.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my impression. It's like with 1%, you're not going to have any sort of like measurable statistical effect either. So, I mean, why would advertisers change their bidding? Right. So it's like, okay, so if you're saying 30-ish percent in revenue on the publisher side for 1% of the traffic, I mean, that's immaterial on the advertiser's perspective.
Exactly. Right?
So, okay, well, these are less addressable, but how would I even know that? I mean, that would probably just look like statistical noise.
Exactly.
Okay. So the second question, though, is that 5% recovery. Talk to me about that. So that seems kind of low. Would you expect that to, so you said it did increase by 3%. So why do you think that is? And second, I mean, how high would you expect that to go?
Right. So I think, you know, part of it is like kind of ecosystem readiness. The web ecosystem, the way it mainly works from an advertising perspective is you've got DSPs, buying platforms that advertisers are setting up campaigns in. You've got SSPs, which are publisher platforms that are kind of conducting the auctions for publishers. And then you've got kind of the publishers themselves. And the tech needs to change on all of those layers, as well as a whole bunch of other kind of connected things as well, before a lot of these new technologies that are going to replace cookies are ready to go. So, you know, let's start with the DSPs. The big on the web, the five largest DSPs, at least from most conversations I have, are Google's DV360, The Trade Desk, Amazon, Yahoo, probably Criteo's number five. That'll change for different publishers and whatever, but those five are pretty big ones. In January, only one of those five was conducting really any purchasing at all in cookieless environments, which was Criteo, who was pretty far ahead of the game. Google's DSP is doing some amount of testing, but it's pretty small. They're not even allowing advertisers to do it themselves. So it's only kind of behind the scenes things they're testing. The Trade Desk isn't doing any testing right now of the privacy sandbox technology at all. They've got they're working on ID technology that they think is the way to go here, which is a different part of the conversation. Yahoo came online with privacy sandbox buying, I want to say last month sometime. So basically, like, you've got these other players in the ecosystem. And then you've got the DSPs, and like they weren't all ready, and some of them were buying, some of them were not even at full scale. You've then got the SSPs, and then there's many of them. And even of those, like the biggest ones weren't fully ready, weren't fully integrated. And then a lot of publishers need to update their own tech on their side to, you know, get the money flowing through. So there's a lot of these other factors that have to be kind of like raised up before the money can fully flow through the system.
So 5% now, where does, I mean, if you had to guess, where does that go to?
You know, everyone is in the ecosystem is incented to get it to 100%. But it's a question of who's ready, when, and how fast it happens. And you know, like probably anything else, there will be winners and losers. I think people who are further ahead will capture that. I wouldn't be shocked also, you know, it's different in a lot of ways, but it reminds me somewhat of GDPR when that came into force back in 2018, where no one was ready. When GDPR mm-hmm. came into effect on May 25th, 2018 or whatever, like no one was ready. I'm like,
right.
The internet in general, like did not have GDPR stuff in place. And over the next couple of months, like it got cleaned up and got better. And a lot of work's gone on after that too. But I do wonder a little bit here if this will be a similar thing where there's some like disruption for 3 or 4 months when everyone's like, oh my God, this isn't working. We've got to really change what we're doing. And that will force a lot of kind of change behaviors and things to happen. So like that's a possible outcome here is there's like months of disruption before it gets back to, you know, where we all want it to be at.
Right. On the publisher side, does adapting into this just mean integrating closely with the privacy sandbox tools that are available to publishers?
Yeah. And so most publishers, Prebid is the open source software that nearly all publishers on the web use to like run their programmatic advertising. And Prebid now is fully upgraded to support all these things, but publishers have to like go get the new version of the code, implement it. And then within Prebid, all the publishers, SSPs that they partner with have their own like code within Prebid. all those need to be updated as well. So it's not rocket science per se, but for publishers, many of whom are fairly strapped in terms of their resources, like they've got to make some number of changes and upgrades to get ready. They don't need to do, it's not a ton, but work is work and it takes time to happen.
Yeah. And then on the advertiser side, I mean, that's also integrating with like the attribution API and
exactly.
And but that's a whole infrastructure adaptation, right? That's much more challenging, I think.
100%. And somewhat when you get into the sandbox, attribution API is a very radical change to the way advertisers measure performance,
right,
and protected audiences, which is the other big piece of the sandbox, is an enormous change to the way targeting works for advertisers and really requires an entirely retooled system.
Right. The first time you were on, we were talking about Turtle Dove, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
Which is no more, right? Just for those who aren't familiar, what talked about protected audiences was Fledge, right?
Turtle Dove was the initial part of the privacy sandbox for audience-based buying. It is extraordinarily complex and extraordinarily privacy-proof, and really almost like impractical from a like functional perspective. It just wouldn't work. So Google came up with a kind of scaled back version of Turtle Dove called Fledge, and then Fledge eventually got rebranded to protected audiences.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, because they keep moving to these more and more like anodyne names.
Yep.
There's publisher adaptations. So there's ad tech adaptations. Publisher adaptations is really just kind of a function of integrating the ad tech integrations. To my mind, the advertiser side integrations are more complex, right? So if you're talking about, you know, ad attribution API, I mean, that's a data science. That's an infrastructure project. That's going to radically change the way that people think about like ROAS, right? Or measure it. Right. And so
100%. Yeah. Yeah.
And in many ways, it's difficult for someone else to do that for you. Right. It's difficult to spin up like a SaaS product that can do that for you. I mean, a lot of times we're talking about like measurement of ROAS in particular. There's just a lot of considerations that go into that on the advertiser side. And it's very sort of like context dependent.
Yeah.
Right. So that's like sort of dragging the advertisers along is probably the biggest lift. Right.
I think that's a really big point. I think this is a place where you know more than I do. Like on the publisher side, like attribution is something that like we know somewhat about, but like we're not in the thick of. So it's like we know enough to be dangerous, but like not to really get into it. But I would say that I think one thing that a little bit prepares advertisers for this is the transition to SK Ad Network that happened in app on iOS, you know, 2 years ago or whatever. It's not the same, but it's similar in some concepts. Or at least I think if you are already, I mean, advertisers, you know better than I do, already have to integrate multiple kinds of attribution data into their system to understand like the bigger picture of what's going on, whether that's via MMM or some other kind of approach.
Right.
This is just another stream that you've got to deal with that is, you know, similar to some other stuff that you're looking at. So it's work, but and again, like you know better than I do, but hopefully work that is doable and can be built out.
It is. So the problem, yes, agree. The problem is there are a large plurality, if not majority, of advertisers that haven't really done that adaptation. So first of all, there's a couple problems with SK Ad Network. One is it was dysfunctional at the launch. So no one was really incentivized to fully integrate into it. The second is that the MMP, which are the mobile measurement partners, they just continue to do fingerprinting and kind of convinced advertising clients, no, this is fine. This is durable. This is reliable going forward, which it won't be soon. And then, you know, third is Facebook never integrated with it. Like, so they're still, I mean, they only recently have really scaled up the traffic that is compatible with SK Ad Network 4.0. So, and that's, I mean, that's the most recent one. So SK Ad Network 4.0 is, you know, night and day superior to 2 and 3. The 2 is what they launched with ATT and 3 was like the upgrade, but it still leaves some things to be desired. I think the ads attribution API is better than it. So I guess the idea here is like, you know, ATT is almost 3 years old. And there's still publishers, advertisers you talk to, like, oh yeah, whatever. Like we use MMP, finger or probabilistic attribution, as they call it. So you know, it takes a lot to drag some of these people. And it's just understandable, right? Because it's a lot of work and that's not what their skill set is. They don't have any, you know, internal domain expertise around this stuff. So yeah, I agree. I mean, as you could sort of point to a moment in the future where yes, that will be true, but it's years. You sort of like measure that sort of lapsed time in years. But talk to me about publishers, because I mean, so you said, okay, the adaptation is really just integrating with the ad tech ecosystem needs sort of like get there. And then the publishers really just need to integrate the upgraded tools. But do you think like commercially or like psychologically publishers are ready for this?
Generally, no. I think, you know, you wrote a piece a few weeks ago, a month ago, you know, is the web whistling past the graveyard, I think is the phrase. I think that most publishers, when you talk to them in quiet rooms, when, you know, no one's around listening, like, you know, and but we're on the list, like we all don't know. for somebody like us, we have the benefit of having a very large team that is very savvy. We feel like we're very far out of things, but like, you know, we could be wrong. We could be going down the wrong path. Like, we don't know. For a lot of publishers who are very small teams who really can't manage a lot of this stuff, like it's, I think it's scary and people are definitely worried. There's a lot of conversations people are having about like, how do they diversify? How do they get less reliant on advertising in general? I mean, you know, big move over the last couple of years for a lot of publishers is like, you know, really focusing more on affiliate commerce and you know, right. other revenue streams that are more, you know, defensible in this sort of changing environment, although have their own set of challenges as well. So I think it's a big thing where I think people are definitely concerned and trying to figure out what the right thing to do is.
Yeah. Are there any components or tools within the privacy sandbox that you believe are underrated or will like sort of at scale perform better than people expect, right? So you talked about that 5% can go, I noticed you didn't give me a number, but that's fine. I won't hound you about that. But so like, are there any tools in the privacy sandbox that you think are kind of like outperform expectations?
So protected audiences is, you know, the primary audience targeting component of the privacy sandbox. To be like schizophrenic for a second, it is an utter disaster in terms of a lot of the features of it, like don't work right. Like it doesn't support video. It is has all kinds of latency issues. It is, you know, it doesn't support a bunch of use cases. The IAB Tech Lab came up with a big analysis of it that was flawed in some ways, but had a lot of good data points in it. Like it has a lot of problems, predicted audiences on the one side. On the other side, if Google can fix them and the industry can get behind a lot of it, it's really cool. It has a super bunch of cool features that can really create a, like, not only can it replace a lot of the use cases of the past in a more privacy-friendly way, it creates a whole bunch of new use cases that are really interesting and potentially novel and can open up a whole bunch of new opportunities. So, you know, the problems are really real and really have to be fixed. But I think if they can be fixed, it could actually be amazing. It's just a question of how long it takes to get there. And is the web right. around when it does get there?
Yeah, and just to remind people, so Fledge / protected audience is a kind of like a tool for remarketing, right? So I could reach someone that, you know, yeah. I've seen before in some way.
It is more sophisticated in the sense that like you can do more and more novel things with like one good example, like remarketing is oversimplified in some cases where like, you know, one of the use cases were in some early talks about how it could work is we can do audience onboarding via with quote unquote remarketing. Where it's like, if we know a user on one of our sites matches a user in one of our advertisers' customer lists, we can drop them in an interest group and effectively make them targetable by the advertiser. It's actually their customer list that's now being targeted, and they weren't actually necessarily in market for their product because it was on one of our properties. But it's a way to actually use remarketing in a way to enable, again, these are kind of more novel use cases.
Yeah. So on mobile, Google has announced they haven't really, it's not available yet, I don't think in beta. But they've announced the protected app signals, which is somewhat similar. So you can collect sort of behavioral signals and use those for those can be used for targeting. What do you think about Topics API? How do you feel about that? What do you think about the performance opportunity there?
The best thing I can say about Topics is it's better than nothing. It's not okay. Like, I don't think it's huge. I think like if it works at the best possible capacity, it might be to talk about like, you know, that recovery rate, like maybe it could be 5, maybe 10% of the total, but I doubt 10. I think 5 would be a win for that. Like it's again, not nothing, but it's not that big of a deal.
Got it. And so kind of the flip side of that question is, does Privacy Sandbox achieve the optimal balance across privacy preservation and advertising efficacy? So in other words, are there aspects of Privacy Sandbox that you view as unnecessarily ineffective, right? So that was my argument with SK Ad Network, and which is demonstrably true in light of 4.0 being released. Well, they know what to do to make this effective. I don't think they had to learn that. They've had ITP out for years and years, right? They didn't have to learn what to do to make 2.0 better. You know, they knew. And so they being Apple. Apple launched something that was, to my mind, deliberately destructive. Like they could have achieved the same level of privacy preservation while also providing more efficacy to advertisers. It was deliberately destructive to the advertising ecosystem. And I wrote about that, this piece called Pyrrhic Privacy, right? It's like, well, we're going to measure the privacy effectiveness by how much value we destroy. That's a yardstick. It's okay. Yeah. How many billions got wiped out? Then we did a good job. Yeah. Right. But yeah. Do you think that's true here? Or do you think they've actually, that Google has achieved sort of like the optimal balance there? Could there be tools that, you know, would replace any of these components that would be better while still providing the same level of privacy preservation?
Two things. Number one, back to my prior comment, I think that, you know, you kind of have to answer your question now and later. Now, the Privacy Sandbox, protected audience in particular, is not ready for prime time and has a bunch of problems with it that need to be fixed. So today it is not the optimal balance. I think in the future it could be much closer to the optimal balance, and I think that's a real thing. But I think, again, a lot needs to be done to get there. But philosophically, it's in a good place, which is something. I think the other thing is that one thing that I think Google should really consider, and we saw this, so another thing that's kind of come into play in the last month or so is Microsoft, which has Edge, which is, you know, 3% of browsers out there or whatever, right, came out with their own version of protected audiences, which they call the Ad Selector API. I may be getting the name wrong, but it's a modified version of protected audiences that has a few kind of novel extra features layered on top of it. And it's not perfect either. But one of the main things that it changes is in protected audiences, logic is in the browser. And that has a bunch of privacy benefits because no data goes to servers, but it has a bunch of negatives because browsers are on people's computers and have performance issues and can't store everything and like have only limited capabilities in certain cases. And like that has a whole bunch of problems. Microsoft's solution is to use trusted execution environments, which are servers, but are highly trusted servers and a whole bunch of criteria around them where data cannot leave those servers under nearly any circumstances. And therefore it is also privacy preserving. And I think moving Sandbox has some trusted execution environment components, mainly in the attribution APIs. But I think those need to be moved into protected audiences. And I think that could solve a lot of the problems that are there right now.
Do you think a bona fide, genuine TEE can be run by a third party, or does it need to be paired with the browser or the hardware?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, it's probably above my pay grade in the sense that I think it's a question like for real like security and privacy experts who really understand the mechanics of these things. I think there are also things like MPC, multi-party computing, which can be layered on top of trusted execution environments, where you basically have multiple parties running the server simultaneously and no party has enough information on their own. You basically have three parties together and you need all three parties colluding for any one of them to get information. And like there are like via encryption and things like that ways to really kind of enforce that. I think it's a security and privacy question that's probably above my knowledge.
Okay, that's scary. I don't know that many people that know more about this than you do.
Some of the browser engineers I've met on the Chrome team are insanely smart. And like, I would defer to people like that to answer that sort of question. But the fact that Google is generally behind TEEs as a component of things makes me think that like, it could be a real part of the solution.
So I had Ben Savage from Facebook Meta on the podcast in December. And we were talking about, you know, their solution, which is IPA, which uses multi-party compute. It's really fascinating. Right. And so I guess my question kind of has two lenses to it. Right. So the one lens is like, is this possible? Can you do this? Could you make a third party TEE that genuinely protects consumer privacy, or is the very nature of it being third party, does that, you know, jeopardize the privacy project? So that's, I think, no, I don't think that does. I think it's possible. The second is that going to be permitted, right? So if the whole idea here is that, well, you know, we decide what's private and what's not, and any data leaving the user's device or their browser is not private, well, then no, you can't. And it's really just a question of, you know, the what are you trying to achieve? And again, I go back to this idea of Pyrrhic privacy. If what you're trying to achieve is value destruction for a certain set of companies, or to make, you know, your product as an alternative look relatively better, well, then no, you don't care what the reality is of the efficacy balanced against the privacy preservation. You know, I mean, so the issue then is, and it also goes back to consumer perception, right? So, And that's sort of like dovetails with the Pyrrhic privacy idea. Like we talked about this on the podcast you were on last time. If the consumers still think it's creepy, then nothing matters, right? If you achieve total parity from an effectiveness standpoint, and the consumer's like, hey, wait a second, I thought this was more private, but I'm still getting targeted ads. That's creepy. Well, then it doesn't matter what you do. And in fact, making it more performant is just going to hurt you. There's a paper floating around recently, and it was some professors, I think it was HEC in Paris. And they did a study on like consumer perception of advertising targeting. So basically like the consumer basically being utterly ignorant of the actual mechanics behind the scenes. What was their sort of like perception, or how did they respond to getting like an ad served by pure play behavioral personalized advertising, you know, sort of privacy safe advertising or contextual advertising? And surprise, they liked the contextual the best, right? Because they felt like their privacy was being preserved. And it didn't really matter whether the advertiser or whatever the platform was using, like pure play, like genuine personalized advertising techniques or more privacy safe techniques is like, well, no, that seems relevant to me. Therefore, it must be invading my privacy. And I think that's another issue here too. And so the question is like, well, what are the platforms deem acceptable? It's like, well, if we know that they're using these privacy safe techniques, that's fine. Like we'll allow this. And you know, that's one question I have about like the sort of third party TEEs. Like, well, how do they achieve that? Do they just open source the actual technology? And you know, they're like a Red Hat style thing. It's like, well, we're the distributor. You know, we charge on a cloud basis for using it. But you could go on GitHub and just see, you know, the code. Or is it never permitted, right? And I think that's kind of a big open question there. And I've got a follow up, which I don't think I've ever gotten an answer here that was satisfying. Do you view clean rooms as TEEs?
That's a good question. I think clean rooms that are doing activation, I think clean rooms or analysis and things like that is offline. Therefore, it's like doesn't matter. I think if you're doing activation, I think it should be a T if you really think it is going to be privacy preserving. I think clean rooms very much also go to the point of what you were saying before. If it still enables creepy advertising, does it really matter? And, you know, like, and a little bit like, you know, part of these things are like, how far down the road is a thing going to be a problem? Like 20 years from now, the way all digital advertising works will look radically different than today, or will be much more privacy preserving. And of the things that we're talking about today, which will survive to 20 years from now, like, I don't think we have any of those things today. I think clean rooms have, you know, holes and problems in them. I think deterministic IDs have problems in them. I think things like privacy sandbox have problems in them that I think we won't exist in the future. So a little bit, it's a little bit how far down the road is it going to be a problem for these things is sort of the question to answer.
Right. Yeah. So do you view alternative identifiers as a viable replacement for cookies? Is that something that's really just going to replace the cookie in a sort of like one-to-one manner that preserves, you know, targeting and measurement? While creating this consented, you know, relationship with the consumer. I have my own thoughts, but I'd love to hear yours.
Yeah, I don't really see the consent argument of... First thing first, alternative IDs mean a couple of different things. I think we're talking about like hashed email-based deterministic IDs. I think that, in my mind, the consent thing is a little bit of a red herring. Like, I don't see how the consent for that is really materially different than the consent for using a third-party cookie. It's almost all buried in some privacy policy on some site somewhere where you say, by using the site, I consent to XYZ things happening to me, like whatever. Is it better? Maybe a little bit, but, and I'm not a lawyer, but you know, I think that's not the strongest connection. I do think from like just a efficacy perspective, I think they can be, you know, they can be very effective as an advertising tool, which is really good. I think they work from a targeting and measurement perspective very similarly to cookies, which is a real benefit to a lot of the infrastructure that's already been built. I think one of the big problems with them, particularly for the open web, is scale. Most web publishers do not have much scale of that sort of a thing. And the very few that have large scale aren't going to use any of these systems because they're going to be like, no, you got to come to me via clean rooms or whatever to get access to these users. I will say on the flip side, like we're a very good example of this. We work with 5,000 sites of all shapes and sizes, and some of them have extremely high authentication rates. We have sites in the network with 70, 80% authentication. Many of them are very low, but we've tripled the average across the network over the last year via a whole bunch of different tactics for really trying to engage users in smart ways at times when they are willing to share this sort of information, when they are really engaged with the publisher and with the content. And like, it does work. And we've got a lot more to do, but I think like there can be success. It's never going to get to 80% across our network. Maybe we could get to 15 or 20. And like, that could be pretty good and a pretty big part of the solution.
If you say, you know, you've essentially gotten the email, right? Like that, is they're addressable because you have the email. Is that with just some sort of prompt that asks them to give the email for the purposes of targeting? Or does that also include sites that have a login? Right. So like my, you know, what Mobile Dev Memo has a login now, like it's good. So I can I use that? Or does that need to be sort of like front and center when I allow the registration? Or is that just like fair game once they've registered and you can do that?
I think consult your privacy attorney to get the best advice on that would be my simple answer. I think what most people do is make the targeted advertising ride along in any other things you're agreeing to when you sign up for any whatever the service is. When you sign up for mobile.bemba, you're agreeing to some number of things. And this is just one more thing to put on that list, basically.
Okay. Do you think that third-party deprecation ultimately benefits the walled gardens? And I guess there's a, let me attach sort of like a corollary to that question. Do more big publishers become walled gardens as a result of third-party cookie deprecation?
Yes and yes. I think that you wrote another article a couple months ago, like, why is Google doing this? Like, yeah. There is no regulation or regulator or any body telling them they have to do this. In fact, there's a regulator monitoring them to make sure they do it right.
Exactly.
And so it's like an interesting, like, why did they choose to do it now? Like, what pressure is on them to do this? And I get some of the pressure, but some of it is like, how does this benefit you? And it certainly makes the walled garden of Google and other walled gardens like look more attractive because, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And you know, Google has way more capabilities than the one-eyed man in that case. So I think it definitely advantages them. I think, you know, we're already seeing, walled garden is a little bit of a funny word. I think you and others have definitely come up with like a list of like, you know, multiple criteria that define something as a walled garden and what type it is. But we're seeing, you know, large scale publishers with extremely valuable audiences, like the New York Times, like the Financial Times, like the Wall Street Journal at some level, who are basically pulling more and more of their inventory out of programmatic and really only selling directly. And I know that's not like the only criteria for walled garden, but that's a lot more like a walled garden than a publisher who makes all their inventory freely available programmatic. So I think you're definitely seeing that trend start to happen.
Okay. And, you know, feel free to pun. Do you think Google will ultimately limit the functionality of first party cookies? So as a primer here, Apple, there's this cat and mouse dynamic between Apple and really Meta. So they rolled out ITP, I think it was 2017, deprecated third-party cookies completely. Facebook said, okay, well, we're going to first-party cookies. Apple said, okay, I see what you've done. So first-party cookie, meaning the publisher, the website owner, integrates the JavaScript, essentially calls the JavaScript from their page. Even if the JavaScript's hosted off-site, that still counts as a first-party cookie. And so Facebook was operating that way. Apple said, okay, I see what you did here, wise guy. They limit the functionality of first-party cookies down to 24 hours if there's a link decoration, right? So click ID. And so Facebook says, okay, you know, we could go back and forth here forever, but why don't we just do Kappy, right? And so they launched Kappy, I want to say 2019, direct integration with Shopify. Shopify retailers just click a button, turns on Kappy. Nothing really that Apple can do about it. Well, there is. That's my article for next week. Apple has a nuclear option. I don't know if they're going to use it or when. But, you know, the first party cookie was limited here. And Google, to my knowledge, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, they've said nothing about any sort of limitation that they want to apply to first-party cookies. So for the walled gardens, essentially, there's no change in operating procedure here. I mean, if they've got first-party cookies integrated, which, you know, you have to. If you spin up an ad account on Facebook, that's part of the account setup procedure. You have to copy JavaScript code, paste it in. So do you think Google will limit the functionality of first-party cookies? Or does it look, are they kind of content with just third-party cookie deprecation?
To generalize the question a little bit, it's about like the deprecation of tracking surfaces. And I think that, to your point, Apple over the years, particularly in the browser, but now more and more in the app world as well, is deprecating and eliminating more and more tracking surfaces for a variety of reasons. Facebook, annoying Facebook being probably at the top of the list. Google has already restricted cross-site storage access that is not cookies. I forget the names of the other storage options in a browser that were limited by Chrome earlier. So that went away. Then with cookies going away, they're going to start limiting access to IPs probably around the same time frame as when they do cookies. So they are showing a trend of deprecating and removing different tracking services, and that seems to be part of their strategy. They haven't mentioned anything about first-party cookies. I do think a little bit also, like, to your point, like, if Apple's enemy is Facebook, like, it's a little unclear here who Google's enemy is and how much they need. Like, if open web publishers are their enemy, which seems a little silly for them to really care that deeply about that. They don't need to go that far, really, to basically shut the door and everything, because open web publishers are not going to be as sophisticated in terms of what Facebook is doing to get ahead of that stuff.
Right. Yeah. Yes. So, like, remember that I wrote this piece in April 23, the Apple's latest cookie restriction is ad tech whack-a-mole. And what they were doing is they were preventing the CNAME cloaking, right? So you had all these, so it wasn't the publishers themselves, it was the, you know, kind of intermediaries, measurement intermediaries that were doing that. So they were allowing basically their through a CNAME cloaking, so made it look like their cookie essentially was signed by the website owner. So there it's just like, you know, ad tech finds a way, right? It's like there's always something, like, unless it's at the hardware level, right? Which is, or it's a policy level, right? It's ATT was very effective, right? And if you own the browser, well, you can do whatever you want, right? And that's why, you know, I think ITP has for the most part been, you know, effective, although they've had to kind of like constantly iterate on it because, you know, these workarounds have been found. Okay. So there was an article on AdExchanger a while back, and I don't remember, it was like a publisher management company or something. And maybe it was just a large publisher. And they were saying, look, you know, it wasn't an article. It was a podcast. And, you know, the woman that was being interviewed by Allison Schiff was saying, look, you know, just testing this is a pain.
right? And, you know, it takes our attention away from other things. And at 1%, should we do it? It's painful. And I might be just totally butchering what she actually said. But she was making the point that just testing this is hard to do.
Yep.
So how would you recommend a publisher go about testing the privacy sample? Or would you? At this point, would you? And if so, how would you recommend they go about doing that?
I think, to be honest, I don't think most publishers need to test. I think they should enable things. So like, as money starts flowing through these new pipes, like they'll start to capture it. I think testing it to that point is complicated. It distracts from a lot of your other core businesses. Unless you have like real reasons to test components, like you should probably rely on the, you know, smallish number of other people like us who are putting data out into the world and use that. You know, like, what, you know, if you've got, you know, some kind of database capabilities, like run some queries and get some data and confirm that like you're seeing similar things to what people like us are seeing. But I think otherwise I would not invest too much time in it because it can turn into a total time suck.
Got it. So awkwardly, I'm going to circle back to the topic we just discussed prior to the testing issue, which is alternative identifiers / you know, the kind of workaround stuff. So you wrote a big Twitter thread about this recently. But talk to me about ID bridging, because I thought that was kind of like an interesting idea, and it's sort of like a perfect example of like one of these kind of workarounds that is, you know, sort of pursued in order to just get around the policy or the actual intervention.
Yep. So ID bridging, the basic point, drop a background for programmatic advertising. OpenRTB is the protocol by which all programmatic advertising happens. It's just a definition of data that publishers and SSPs send to DSPs, and then DSPs use to decide whether to bid. And when they bid, they send the bid data back. When publishers and SSPs send data to a DSP, they send a whole bunch of different data points. They send like the URL of the page, the timestamp. They send information about what kinds of ads are acceptable, what the ad sizes are, like all kinds of different data get sent through. And one really important field is a field called buyer UID. And that's, I'm oversimplifying a little bit for the purposes of the basic point. The buyer UID is where you put the third-party cookie that the buyer uses to decide whether or not to buy a user. Impressions, ad impressions that have a buyer UID associated with them monetize very well and get many, many bids. Ad impressions that do not have a buyer UID monetize very poorly. And so for a long time, it didn't really matter that much because there was enough monetization flowing through the system where nobody really needed to worry about it. Nearly all Chrome impressions had buyer UIDs associated with them, and therefore they did well. No one could really get anything in Safari anyway, so it didn't matter. With cookie deprecation coming in the near future on the Chrome side, there's been more and more of a push to figure out, hey, are there ways we can populate the buyer UID in cases where Chrome is missing that ID or Safari also? And what are ways you can do that to get more demand as a publisher? So, you know, that's the basic concept. The good example I use is if you're a publisher and you run a website and you know for a given user who's on your site, who's logged in, like you know their email, you know who they are, and you see the buyer UID being passed to it, being passed to one of your partners, you can store that link and say, this email is mapped to this buyer UID. I know this fact about this user. I know this. If later on you see the same user come back to your site and the buyer UID is missing for whatever reason, third party cookie got deleted, whatever thing happened, but you still know that person, you can put that third party cookie ID back in the buyer UID field, thereby increasing the demand for that user significantly. Like that is a clear case where you're like, I want to be able to do this. This has real value. This is totally on the up and up. Good for the advertiser. Everybody wins here. That's a good thing. However, on the flip side, you can see how easy this is to abuse, where you could easily also, you know, if you were a nefarious publisher, say, hey, I see this guy, Eric, on my site. And whenever he's on my site, he gets tons of really high value bids. I'm going to store that buyer UID in my system. There's this other guy over here, Paul. Whenever he's on my site, I get terrible bids. He monetizes very poorly. I'm going to take Eric's buyer UID and put it on Paul. And now all of a sudden, you're making way more money in a totally sneaky and not good way. And so like to some level, that's the concept of ID bridging. And a lot of work's being done right now in the industry to figure out what are the acceptable use cases, because a lot of gray area between those two things. What are the acceptable cases where this is good and benefits all players? And one of the cases where this is bad, it should be shut down. So that's like a big kind of topic of right now.
Right. Pretty fascinating. I mean, just how quickly these work. I mean, like, because I guess you've got people, it's all day, every day. This is what they're thinking about, in the face of this massive change.
AdTech finds a way.
AdTech finds a way. So, I mean, I think it's demonstrable, right? That we could see this. You just talked about it, that you've measured this. When you lose the addressability, when you lose the targetability, the impressions are worth less. Talk to me about why that is. Why does contextual targeting deliver less value than personalized advertising? Why, or personalized targeting, or personalization, or behavioral targeting? Why does it deliver less value?
I think part of it is the nature of an ad auction in general. It's not necessarily that it delivers less value. It's that it has fewer advertisers to which it's relevant. Auctions with every ad on the internet at this point is an auction. And ads with auctions that are more dense, with more bidders, are more likely to end up with a higher result. And auctions that are sparse, with fewer bidders, are more likely to end up with a lower result. So you can certainly have contextual auctions that only have one or two bidders still end up very, very high and very valued. But those are less likely than auctions that are very dense and have lots of behavioral data in them also, because it brings more people to the table, basically. I think that's, in my mind, that's the simplest reason why that's true.
Well, okay. So why are people less interested in bidding that? I mean, I think it's a fairly obvious answer, but people dispute it. No, context is enough. Think about The Economist. If you get, okay, yeah, fine. There's a couple of websites that probably have average incomes of their audience that are very high, right? But why is it that people are less willing to bid on a contextual basis? Why, or they're going to bid lower? Why is it? Just talk me through the case, because we could see it. And I mean, I have my own explanation for it. I wrote a piece called The Millionaire's Mall. I won't go into it. But like, when someone comes back and says, no, contextual bidding is just as good. Contextual targeting is just as good. So Meta had its DMA workshop 2 weeks ago. And there was a privacy activist present. And they said, why can't you just do contextual app targeting? Why do you need to have person? What's the answer to that?
I mean, Facebook's one of the best examples. I think it's about like endemicness and value of content. If you are on a site or an app or whatever, where users are looking at buying a car, contextual auction is great. Like, car advertisers will line up all day long to buy very high prices for highly intent-oriented users that they can actually get a conversion from. Like, no problem at all. If I'm on Facebook and looking at pictures of my friend's cat, there's no contextual value to that ad impression.
Zero context.
And there's everything in between those things. But like, it's right. Like, many impressions on the internet have very low context associated with them. I actually think one of the worst types of content for context is news, and everybody wants mm-hmm. to support journalism and news and whatever. And it's like, most news is fairly contextless. Like, if I'm reading right. an article about like what's going on in Gaza, like forget about brand safety issues. Like, who targets me there? Right, like, what's the endemic advertiser for that? They don't exist.
Yeah, because context also is a single signal, but it doesn't relate to the person's ability to buy, their intent to buy, right? Like, that's the issue with Reddit, right? So they're talking about like, well, we've got behavioral advertising, we can see what the person's interested in. I mean, because okay, yes, if you keep note of the subreddits they browse, so they have contextual and then they have what they've called behavioral. So contextual is like, and they talked about this in the S1, like, I'm on the camping subreddit, people that sell camping gear should advertise to me. That's pure play contextual. And they said we have behavioral, right? So we'll see what they like over time. Like, what subreddits do they browse? Yes, fine. But that doesn't tell me anything about their ability to make a purchase, right? Their intent to make a purchase, the timeline over which they want to make a purchase. Now, to your point, if I'm surfing, I want to buy a car right now.com, there's a lot captured in that, yeah. Right? But if I'm surfing the camping subreddit, it tells me nothing. Yeah. Nothing about this person's ability to buy a tent or a sleeping bag or their proclivity towards buying one, how and what sort of timeline they want to buy one. It gives me no indication. And just the fact because they browsed /r/Big Ben, which is a big, you know, state park in Texas, or /r/Yosemite and /r/camping, that also tells me very little. Right. Yeah, and so exactly. It's just obvious why. Now, you can make the moral argument all day, but I don't think you can make the effectiveness argument. You just can't.
You can't. I totally agree with you.
Okay, last one. Could you ever imagine a company launching a less privacy-safe browser, right? So you go, okay, you've got Brave, you've got, you know, Firefox. Okay, we're gonna Safari, and that's a selling point, right? Like, we've eliminated cookies. We're privacy. What if a browser said, no, we're gonna go all in on tracking.
Yeah.
Use this browser if you want to get the most relevant ads possible. We're gonna track everything you do. Could you see that happening?
Yeah, I made a joke about this on Twitter a couple of years ago. I think one of the more relevant actual benefits you would get is like, I am so sick of being logged out of websites. Like,
yeah.
Like, right. For the love of God, can I just be logged into everything all the time? It's my desktop. Like no one. Yeah. If someone takes it, like, more power to them. They can order my Amazon account, like whatever. But I'm like so tired of being logged out all the time from different things. Like, so it's like, and a lot of that's like, there's security added to that, but there's a lot of privacy to those choices. Right. And it's like a browser that was like, you're logged in all the time to everything would be amazing. And if the side benefit was more targeted ads, like that sounds pretty good. So maybe you and I should start a business where we launch the least privacy browser.
Last topic. Talk to me about Google's generative search experience, right? So is this, do you think this is like totally transformative to the digital advertising ecosystem? My sense was at Google I/O, I didn't really see anything that totally blew me away. I didn't see anything that I felt like was, you know, the sort of like next big milestone of the internet experience for consumers. But talk to me about that. Do you see that totally transforming search, totally transforming search advertising? Or do you see it as, okay, this is just one other avenue available to consumers for connecting with information?
I mean, there's like the general point of like, I think most would agree that generative AI is a massively disruptive technology that will change many, many things. I think my state, which I agree with heavily on the one hand. On the other hand, I think that like, I don't think most of them are really there yet. I don't think anyone's figured out the killer app for generative AI at this point, SGE included. But I think that you look at things like SGE and you think about like, how could this transform the way things operate today is like a little scary to think about what those deltas could be. Again, as a web-oriented company, seeing Google basically have search results that are the entire contents of an article, that by the way, it's scraped from one of our sites or a big publisher or whatever, and like regurgitates the content in some new way, has a whole bunch of like risks and kind of scary aspects to it. So I think like that's one element that's part we think about a lot. I do think it's interesting to think about like how, as Google pulls more and more content onto its search results pages, how does that affect the advertising that goes on there? One like very like this was like small thing, and maybe this is a nothing, but I saw recently on like Search Engine Land, I think that Google changed the definition. Like within Google Ads, like when you're like buying search ads, I forget the name of it, but there's a checkbox or whatever for I only want my ads like above the fold. Like it's not above the fold, but it's like some name like that. It's like high on the page basically. Mm-hmm. And they changed the definition of it to allow the ads to be lower down the page. And it made me wonder whether they're going to even more and more push ads down the page, as long as the performance works, but get less visibility and less things out there. So just like thinking about how it's going to change how buyers buy in the Google Ads environment is sort of interesting to think about. And like, what will those set of changes look like?
Yeah. Yeah. My sense is like, I think people make a lot of assumptions about the form that, you know, generative AI is going to take. And they sort of anchor those assumptions to just what we're used to now, right? So like, okay, well, here's an application of generative AI. And I think Google I/O, I mean, they had a couple of examples of that were really good. It was like, okay, well, I'm searching for a recipe, and it gives me the recipe. Well, that's pretty obvious, right? My sense is like, that just replicates the current use case. Maybe it does it like 5% better or something, but I don't know that, you know, that's not transformative. I mean, that's not sort of like a novel new application of this technology, which does feel like it has the potential to be transformative. So my sense is like people make a lot of assumptions about, you know, their thinking kind of is too constrained, right? And that's why I've kind of taken a pass on like the generative AI applications for specifically creative production, just because I feel like, well, is that really the thing that unlocks the value of this? Because to my mind, the platforms capture all the value. They just capture all of it because they've got all the data and they can pair it and they can do the real-time create asset production. And they've got all of the data. And increasingly, they have all of the modeled sort of conversion estimates mm-hmm. that they're not shared. They won't be shared widely. Yeah. And so how would you construct that feedback loop? But that's probably a topic for a separate podcast. Paul Bannister, you are a fount of information on this topic. How can people learn from you? Where can they find you on the internet to learn from you?
Find me on Twitter. PBannis is my handle there. Sorry, X. I'll call up Twitter for forever. Sorry. Or on LinkedIn. Happy to connect there and chat with people.
Yeah. I was given so LinkedIn, X, formerly Twitter. I was given a presentation the other day, and I was referring to this company. It was, I don't know if you're familiar, it's kind of the app ecosystem, but it's data.ai, right? But no one calls it data.ai. Everyone calls it App Annie because it was originally named App Annie. It was such a unique name. And so they renamed data.ai a few years ago. And I kept referencing this chart from data.ai, but I would say App Annie. And then there's someone from the company in the audience. Like, hey, you know, you're insulting. So it's Joe, you know, someone in jest. Yeah, you're insulting so-and-so. They work at data.ai. You keep calling it App Annie. It's like, there's three companies that I will never refer to by their new names. Facebook will always be Facebook.
Yep.
Twitter will always be Twitter, and App Annie will always be App Annie, except that they were acquired recently. They were acquired 2 weeks ago by Sensor Tower. So now they're Sensor Tower, and I might call them Sensor Tower. But Paul Bannister, thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for being so generous with your insights, and I hope to have you on once more.
Yeah, thanks very much for the time, Eric. It was great to be here.